bit of a crunch for time. We're going to just start right in here tonight. Are any of our guests here for the first time? Can I just get an idea? No first timers. Nobody's here for the first time. Oh, one lady's here for the first time. Okay. English speaking? Understanding English is your first language? Or? Okay, so we're going to say a couple remarks, introductory remarks, throw out a couple thoughts just to, for the benefit of our first-time guest, just to help her get up to speed, so to speak. So we're called the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So international society, everybody understands that. And consciousness, that's a pretty common word, awareness. Krishna, you might not be familiar with Krishna. Well, in this tradition, Krishna is a name for God. So by saying that, you probably immediately can conclude that, oh, these people believe in God. That would be a correct conclusion or a correct assumption. We do. And by saying that Krishna is a name for God, that would also might lead you to think, well, so they're saying that God has a name. Does that mean, is he a thing or a person? Or because things have names, persons have name. Well, the correct answer to that question would be person. That's part of one of the core beliefs that as members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, we believe that, one, that there is a God, and two, that he's a person. He's got a name, Krishna. Okay? Now, you might be a little disappointed to hear that, because sometimes our experience with people in general and in our own lives is people can be disappointing. People are disappointing in different ways. We're disappointed by people in that a lot of times in relationships we have with people, we feel that we've been betrayed. People don't live up to our expectations of, character and so forth. And also people can be disappointing in that we see all people, even the most spectacular people that we know about in contemporary human society and throughout history, they all get old, sick, die. So in this way, it's not so exciting to hear that God's a person because, naturally we might tend to think that, well, if he's, person means all those things. Well, that's where we got to say something, comment, that no, God is a person, but he doesn't have any of those defects. See? He's a perfect person. And to say he's a perfect person means that he doesn't get old, sick, and die like every other person we know of in this world. He doesn't disappoint anybody. He doesn't, no character defects. He doesn't betray anybody, let anybody down in any way. He's a perfect person. So, as I said, he's eternal. His knowledge is perfect. That's to say that he doesn't make any mistakes. He doesn't forget anything. I'm just throwing a few kind of, characteristics out here to just kind of round this idea out. He's always happy. And maybe the one exception to that he's always happy is that sometimes he feels sad to see that we, who are, and this is introducing a new idea, we are part and parcels of that person. And as we're also persons, and we have an eternal spiritual personal relationship with that supreme person, Krishna. Fortunately, we are here in this material world, and we are forgetful of that relationship at this present point in time, and that makes Krishna unhappy. Krishna's unhappy about that. So that's the one exception to that idea that how he's never unhappy. He's unhappy to see that we, his parts and parcels, his spiritual expansions, his spiritual children, that's probably the easiest way to kind of visualize that or get that idea. His spiritual children are suffering here in this material world under the illusion that we don't have an eternal spiritual relationship with him. So he's unhappy about that. Some other things is he's the proprietor of everything. Being the original cause of everything, he's the proprietor of everything. So that's another aspect of his personality. He's controlling everything. And he's the most attractive person because he's the most beautiful person. His beauty makes him the most attractive. What else? And he has no ulterior motives in any of his activities. In other words, here in this material world, people have ulterior motives. They're doing something, and maybe their motivation for doing that particular thing is not the best. You know, but Krishna is basically, he never functions outside the principle of pure love. He's desiring, in all his interactions with his parts and parcels, his spiritual children, he's just trying to give love, and he's very happy when he receives, when he feels that that love is being reciprocated back. And that's ultimate, that's what he desires. He desires to be able to experience reciprocal loving relationships with his spiritual expansions or his spiritual children. And that's what this material world is actually, it's created by him to give us an opportunity to reestablish that eternal loving relationship that we have with him. So that kind of gives you a bit of an idea in general, you know, what our understanding is about God, that he's a person. And of course, you know, to say that he's a person, that's, it means that there's very, like all of us, it'd be very specific details about his life. And it was like, you know, as people, we are in relationship with other people. We live in a certain place. We have certain friends. We have certain activities, et cetera, et cetera. And Krishna is no different. And so Krishna also is a person that has, you know, associates and activities and so forth and so on. So now we're going to, for the rest of this talk, kind of talk a little bit more about, it's going to sound, it might sound a little in-house to you, but hopefully with that background information, you're going to be able to understand what we're talking about. So I'm going to read a little something from the one of our scriptures called the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is, you know, the, when I say scriptures, kind of the equivalent to the Bible, you know, for us, or the, to the Christians, or the Quran for the Muslims, or the Torah for the Jews. We have our scripture is called the, well, we have more than one, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So I'm going to read a little something from our scripture and then say something a little bit more about that. So this is reading from a chapter called The Prayers by Queen Kunti. And this is Queen Kunti speaking at this point. She says, "The Almighty Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, having observed the great danger, that great danger was befalling his unalloyed devotees, who were fully surrendered souls, at once took up his Sudarshan disc to protect them." And in his commentary on this particular text, our spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, who is the founder acharya for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and in plain and simple language, that means he's the person who started this movement. He brought it over from India. There was no Krishna Consciousness movement here in America prior to 1965. So he brought this culture, this knowledge, this tradition from India here. And so he found it. And he's, acharya means teacher by example. And he showed us by his own example and, you know, his own personal life, how to actually be devotees of Krishna. He didn't just explain it to us in words. He actually demonstrated by his own life's activities how to be a devotee of Krishna. So in his commentary upon this verse, he says, "When the Lord saw that there was no time for the Pandavas to counteract the Brahmastra as a weapon that was being targeted at them, something like an atomic bomb, he took up his weapon, even at the risk of breaking his own vow. Although the battle of Kurukshetra was almost finished, still, according to his vow, he should not have taken up his own weapon. But the emergency was more important than the vow. He is better known as Bhaktavatsala, or the lover of his devotee. And thus he preferred to continue as Bhaktavatsala than a worldly moralist who never breaks his solemn vow." So this is kind of touching upon that last point I made when I was describing about how, you know, some of the attributes of Krishna being a perfect person, that he has love for all his spiritual children, and especially those spiritual children who are already established in a favorable service relationship with him. You know, not to say that he, you know, doesn't love the others, but he has particular affection for those living entities or those spiritual children who are already, you know, situated in that way. And that's what's being referred to here, just to give you a little background information and you know, for the rest of the devotees. So Krishna took made a promise before the battle of Kurukshetra that he would participate, but he wouldn't fight. You know, he wouldn't fight. He would just, he could be an advisor, a chariot driver like that, but he wouldn't actually take up a weapon and fight. So that was his, you know, the promise or the vow he made. But actually, it's being mentioned here that on this occasion, Krishna thought it was more important to protect his devotee, who was threatened at that point. There was a Brahmastra weapon being directed, or like as I said, the equivalent of an atomic bomb, but it's the weapon is such that it could be pinpointly directed towards a very specific target without creating like mass destruction. So anyway, one of the devotees had this weapon directed right towards their embryo, and it was disturb a pregnancy. So anyway, Krishna decided rather than observe his, promise, his vow of not to take up a weapon in this battle. He said, no, more important to protect my devotee. So he actually took up his own personal weapon called the Sudarshan Chakra, and he counteracted that Brahmastra weapon, which, as I said, is like something similar to an atomic bomb by doing so. And that was one occasion. And actually, there was another occasion in the Battle of Kurukshetra where he did the same thing when his very close friend Arjuna and devotee, and who's happened to be one of the military commanders. Actually, Krishna was acting as his chariot driver throughout the Battle of Kurukshetra. And there's a little story here that what happened was the commander-in-chief of the other army in the battle, the Kauravas, he he commented to his general, I think I don't know if I'm getting the titles right, who's the commander-in-chief. But anyway, the general of one of the armies, or the king, actually. The king, his name was Duryodhana. He mentioned to his commander-in-chief, whose name was Bhishma, who happened to be the grandfather, as such, of the Arjuna and his brothers. He said, I don't think you're fighting as hard as you can be fighting. I think that because of your affection for the Pandavas, you are, holding back. So this was, Bhishma took this as a great insult. You know, he kind of felt, as a Kshatriya, I'm duty bound to fight and give it my all. So he said, oh, okay, yeah, that's how you're feeling. So in that case, he says, then I'll show you. I'm going to fight so hard tomorrow, in the next day's battle, that all the Pandavas, at least Arjuna, will be finished, vanquished. Either that or Krishna's going to have to take up a weapon. So Duryodhana was very happy to hear that. And he said, okay, that's good. That's good news. And what is your plan to accomplish that feat? He said, well, I have these 5 arrows here, and I'm going to use these 5 arrows tomorrow to, defeat the Pandavas. Anyway, so he said, okay, well, let me have those arrows. The king said, let me have those arrows. He wanted to hold on to them. I'll keep those for safekeeping. So anyway, so to cut out a few of the details, but what happened was the next day in the battle, sure enough, Bhishma was fighting so fiercely that towards the end of the battle, there came a point at which it looked like he was going to actually, unless Krishna did something, he was going to, Bhishma would be killing Arjuna. So sure enough, at some point in the battle, what happened was, Krishna came down from the chariot. He was the chariot driver. He came down from the chariot. He grabbed the chariot wheel and he started rushing towards Bhishma with the wheel of the chariot. That was going to be his weapon and to defend Arjuna. And when Bhishma saw that, then he desisted from fighting and he said, okay, well, that's okay. Now I've done what I set out to do, which is I made the declaration that either Krishna's going to have to take up a weapon to defend Arjuna, or Arjuna's going to be killed. And here you've taken up a weapon to defend Arjuna, so there's no need for me to do anything further. So once again, that's illustrating this point that Krishna was more concerned with his protecting his devotee out of his great affection for his devotee than he was in maintaining his vow as a worldly moralist who never breaks his solemn vow like that. And there are other examples of this this particular point. Actually, this is a very important point for devotees. Actually, Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, in another one of his commentaries, another one of his purports, another verse, he says, he makes the comment, says, the highest quality of the Supreme Lord is that he is Bhakta Vatsal, which means he's always extremely pleased with his devotees. So Prabhupada refers to this quality of Krishna as the highest or the most important quality of Krishna, is that he's extremely affectionate and towards his devotees. So in another place in one of his books, Prabhupada mentions, gives another example of this point of how Krishna's Bhakta Vatsal. There was he gives the example of this Brahmin who was, he was very poor, and but he was very devoted. And on a regular daily basis, he would perform worship, but he had practically no means. You know, he was just a poor, simple Brahmin. And then at one point he heard that actually worship could be done within the mind. Manasapuja, it's called. You know, if one doesn't have facility for some reason or another to perform it with, you know, dravya, gross physical objects. So he decided, okay, I'm going to take up that worship. So within his mind, because, you know, he had nothing to do it with otherwise, within his mind he was bringing water from the sacred rivers in golden pots, and he was bathing the deities, you know, with that, in a temple that he had constructed within his mind. He was bathing the deities with the waters from the sacred rivers that had been collected in these golden pots, and then he was preparing a very beautiful offering for them of, you know, different foodstuffs, among which he was preparing what's it called, paramana, I think it's sweet rice. It's very nice milk preparation, milk, rice cooked in milk and sweetened. So anyway, so generally that preparation is meant to be served out cold. So he was concerned that, I don't know, I'm cooking this paramana, but I have to check and see if it's, you know, if it's suitable, you know, if it's hotter. So anyway, in his meditation, he touched the sweet rice to check the temperature of it. And lo and behold, he burnt his finger. He was just doing this whole thing within his mind, but when he went to touch in his meditation, when he went to touch the sweet rice to check the temperature, his finger burnt. So in other words, basically what was happening was Krishna was so pleased by the sincerity, by the devotion of this devotee, that he reciprocated in that way. And actually, very shortly after that, Krishna sent messengers, you know, from the spiritual world down to bring that Brahmin back. That Brahmin was immediately liberated, and he went back to the spiritual world shortly after that. Another nice example of this point, about Krishna's very reciprocal with the devotion of his devotees, is this is from the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is a recent incarnation, you know, the devotional incarnation of Krishna, who was present here 500 years ago. There was, in South India, there was a Brahmin. And this particular Brahmin was instructed by his spiritual master that he should read all 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita daily. But one problem this Brahmin had was that he was illiterate. He really didn't know how to read. And say, but at the same time, he was a very sincere devotee, and because he received that instruction from his spiritual master, he didn't feel, I can't just neglect this, I have to do whatever I can do to try to execute this instruction. So on a regular daily basis, he was sitting there in the temple, and he was, you know, holding the Bhagavad Gita there, and he was just kind of, whatever, you know, sometimes turning the pages, sometimes looking at the picture of Krishna, driving Arjuna's chariot. There was a picture, something similar to, well, I don't have a Bhagavad Gita here, but, you know, a picture of Krishna driving Arjuna's chariot on the battlefield there. So he was like that, and he was doing that. That was his regular daily practice. And the other Brahmins in the community there, they were aware that this particular Brahmin was illiterate, and they used to make fun of him. They used to laugh at him and so forth and so on, but, you know, he wasn't disturbed by that. Anyway, on one particular occasion, Lord Chaitanya visited that temple. I can't remember the name of the temple, but Lord Chaitanya visited there, and he saw what was going on. He saw that here's this Brahmin, he's, you know, holding the Bhagavad Gita, and these other Brahmins are, you know, making fun of him and laughing and thinking it's all very, you know, big joke. But at the same time, he could see that this Brahmin was really, you know, absorbed in some way or another in his experience of having, you know, holding the Bhagavad Gita. So he approached him And he said, Brahman, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm trying to execute the instruction of my spiritual master. My spiritual master told me to read Bhagavad Gita 18 chapters every day. And he said, okay, so he said, very good. So, but why are these other Brahmins? Why are they laughing and joking? And he said, well, I'm illiterate and I don't actually know how to read. And they're aware of that, so they're making fun of me like that. He said, but you know, I see that I'm observing you, and I see that you're looking at the Bhagavad Gita, and your tears are coming from your eyes. You're crying. So if you're illiterate, if you don't read, how is that? So he said, well, actually, it's not that I don't read, but I'm looking at the picture. I'm looking at this picture of how Krishna is so kind and so compassionate and so loving and so caring that he's taking on the position of the chariot driver to help his devotee, Arjuna. And actually, in the Vedic culture, that wasn't considered a very prestigious position, you know, to be the chariot driver. It's kind of like being almost on the level of a street sweeper or something like that. It wasn't considered. But Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In order to serve his devotee, in order to help his devotee, he's prepared to take the role of the chariot driver. And so this Brahmin was saying to Lord Chaitanya, he says, when I look at this picture and I just, you know, think about how kind Krishna is and how loving he is and how much he cares about his devotees and everything like that, I become overwhelmed with emotion and I cry. And Lord Chaitanya really appreciated that, and he actually embraced him, and he said, actually, you are the real scholar of the Bhagavad Gita. You are the real scholar. You're the devotee of all these people here. You're the one who really understands this book, Bhagavad Gita. So he was very pleased with him in that way, further illustrating this point about how Krishna is, you know, bhaktavatsal. He's very kind to his devotees, very loving, very affectionate. And there's one of the nice story in this regard. It's Prabhupada told this story himself in a class he gave in 1972 or 3, and I think it was in Mumbai. There was this boy, and he was a very young boy, and he was in a school, and the teacher of the school, every year, he observed a ceremony on the anniversary of the death of his father. So that occasion was coming up, so the teacher requested all the students, okay, because, you know, teachers back in the Vedic culture, in that culture, they didn't receive a salary. The system was that they would teach freely, anybody and everybody, and then the students would offer something in charity. You know, they would give charity to the teacher. They just make donations, and that's how the teachers maintain themselves. So the teacher made a request of all the students. He said, please, I'd like each of you to supply something, some ingredient, something, so that I can do this nice festival on the anniversary of my father's death. So all the students were, you know, saying, okay, well, I could supply this, and I can bring the ghee, and we'll bring the fruits, and we'll bring the vegetables like that. And so in this way, so many different students were volunteering to bring some ingredient. So when it came to the turn for this, you know, one particular boy, he said, well, I have to first check with my mother, because I don't know what we can do. So he said, okay, that's okay. You know, you do that and come back and tell me the next day. So when he went back home and he explained the situation to his mother, he said, son, we're very poor. We can't, you know, we don't have any means to supply anything, you know. And the boy was very, you know, he was just a young boy. And he was very upset. I mean, he was very upset because, you know, imagine how that would make, you know, a young child, be very embarrassing and difficult for him to go back the next day and say to his teacher, when all the other students were offering, they could do this, that, you know, he has to go back and say, I can't do anything, you know. So he was really upset by that. So his mother said, well, you know, it's actually only Krishna can help you, you know, and only God can help you. So he says, well, where do I find? He says, if you go out in the forest, you know, and you call for Krishna, perhaps he'll come and help you. So this was, you know, a young boy, innocent child. So he did that. He followed his mother's instruction, and he went out to the forest, and he was calling out, Krishna, Krishna, you know, Dinabandhu. Dinabandhu means friend of the poor. He was calling out, Dinabandhu, you know, Krishna, like that. So Krishna came, and he explained, this boy explained the situation to Krishna, how, Krishna, you know, this is my situation. I'm a student in the school, and the teacher, et cetera, et cetera. So Krishna said, okay, well, you know, you tell them when you go back tomorrow, tell them that you could supply yogurt. So the boy said, okay, good. Yeah, nobody else has volunteered to supply the yogurt. That sounds good. I'll do that. So he went back and he told the teacher that I'll supply the yogurt. So the teacher was very happy. He says, oh, wonderful. We need that ingredient. So then when a little time passed, and then when the day for the festival came, the boy went back out to the forest, and sure enough, Krishna showed up again, and he gave him a little cup with some yogurt in it. And the boy, as I said, he was very young, he was very innocent, simple, and he thought that was good. He was very happy with that, and he went, took the cup of yogurt, and he went to the school. And when he got there, the teacher said, so-and-so, where is your, where is your offering? Like that. And he said, here it is, teacher, this is the yogurt. And the teacher was, what? That's one little cup of yogurt. This is a feast for hundreds of people. How is that, what is that? He was, he didn't get like angry, but he just was very like, his mood was, he took the cup and he just put it down neglectfully, And he was very, he was disturbed, disappointed, like that. And just as he put it down, because he was, so upset, and he was in a bad mood as a result, and the cup tipped and the yogurt spilled out. And then they went and he was doing some other things like that, Then after a couple of minutes he came back and he noticed, oh, the yogurt spilled out. Now there's no yogurt at all. So he saw the yogurt spilled out there, and he picked up the cup, and then he looked, and lo and behold, the cup was full of yogurt. So, well, how can that be? So he went, okay, there's the yogurt spilled out. That's as much yogurt as could fit in this cup, but here this cup is full again with yogurt. So he says, okay, well, anyway, so he's just to see what was going on, he spilled out the yogurt that was in the cup again. And he looked, and there the cup was full of yogurt. And he did it again, the cup was full of yogurt. So in other words, Krishna gave that boy a spiritual cup of yogurt, you could say. It never became empty. But once again, there's so many different points that could. Prabhupada used told the story to illustrate a different point, but it certainly illustrates the point of how Krishna is reciprocating, with his pure devotees. This boy was very simple, very innocent, but had a lot of, had implicit faith in Krishna, and that Krishna would help him. And Krishna didn't disappoint him. Krishna didn't let him down. Krishna reciprocated with that boy's, sincere devotion, and he supplied him a cup that supplied unlimited yogurt. So that's that story. Very nice pastime. And then one last pastime that Prabhupada uses to illustrate this point, and he did it on more than one occasion, was it's the pastime where when Krishna was present here on earth, there was one demoniac king. His name was Bhomasura. Let me do the time. Okay, good. His name was Bhomasura, and he had the bad habit of kidnapping the daughters of various subordinate kings. Well, they weren't necessarily subordinate kings. They were weaker kings. He would kidnap their daughters, and he would, just keep them for his own sense gratification, more or less. He kidnapped them and kept them captives in his palace like that. So he kidnapped, at one point he kidnapped the daughters of 16,000 different kings. Well, actually, it's not specifically stated that it was 16,000 different kings, but altogether he kidnapped 16,000 princesses. I don't know if there was from 16,000 separate kings, or maybe more than one daughter was from a particular king. But in any event, 16,000 princesses he was holding captive in his palace there, so to speak. So somehow or another, and these princesses, they worked out that there's no way we can get out of here. What are we? We're just women, young girls, and this is like a big, powerful, demoniac king. We're stuck, But somehow or another, they were able to get a message out to Krishna that was their predicament. And they, in that message, they pleaded to Krishna, please, Krishna, come and save us, rescue us, something, So that message got to Krishna, and Krishna, they were his devotees, so he acted upon it. Krishna acted upon it, and he went. He killed that Bhomasura, and he rescued these princesses, So when he finally opened up the place where they were being held captive, and he said to them, okay, he's killed, you're rescued, you're free to go. And, so they everybody's happy, and they kind of were quiet, and they looked down, and Krishna further inquired, well, what's up, what's going on, what's up? They said, look, Krishna, the thing is this, that, we were kidnapped, and we can't now, because if we've been kidnapped and held captive by this demoniac Bhomasura, we can't go back to our father's homes, because, you know, that was Vedic culture, that it was very high level of purity, and they would never, they'd be, you know, just considered impure, and they wouldn't be accepted back in their far parents' homes. So they, you know, they pointed that out to Krishna, and then they also went on to further point out that, and also because we've been in this situation, nobody will marry us. So in other words, okay, you've rescued us, you know, but and now we're free to do as we like, but we can't go back to our father's homes, and nobody will marry us because we've been held captive by this demon. So, you know, we're still in a predicament. So Krishna says, well, then, I mean, okay, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, Krishna, please, you marry us. And Krishna, okay, Krishna thought about it doesn't really say if he thought about it or not, but Krishna agreed to that proposal. And he accepted all of them as his wives. And Prabhupada points out that Krishna, they were his devotees, you know. And Prabhupada points out that Krishna is so kind to his devotees. Not only did he accept them all as his wives, but he didn't, you know, he wasn't in the mentality that, okay, you know, I've got to do this, so I'll just make one big building and put them all in there, and they'll have to just share, you know, rooms and whatever. No. He accepted them as his wives, and he did it, you know, the right way. Prabhupada points out that he constructed 16,000 different palaces, and each one of these princesses was, you know, a wife, you know, to the proper standard. They each had their own palace, and they each, you know, had, Krishna was expanded, actually, at different points in time. Krishna expanded himself into 16,000 different forms in order to associate simultaneously with these 16,000 different princesses who are now his wives, because he didn't want to, you know, if you work it out mathematically, if each wife got to see Krishna one night, you know, it would be quite a few years before each one of them would see, you know, 400 times 4 times 10. It's like, you know, they'd see him once in 40 years or something like that. So anyway, Krishna expanded himself into 16,108 forms, so they would all have the good fortune of having his association on a regular daily basis. So Prabhupada says, and this is like, now I'm quoting here from a lecture Prabhupada gave. He said, this is Prabhupada speaking. He says, Prabhupada speaking on behalf of Krishna here. He says, you have no shelter? You're taking my shelter? Come on. I shall give you all palaces. Come on. Then Prabhupada says, this is Krishna. Take shelter of Krishna. Never mind what is your position. Krishna will accept you and give you all comfort. And then he quotes from the Bhagavad Gita, Sarvadamam Pritchajam Mame Kam Sananam Vraja Aham Tvam Sarva Papevyo Mokshasyami Masujaha. That abandon all varieties of religion, just surrender unto me. I'll protect you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. Prabhupada quoted that verse. Then he went on to say, referring to Krishna, he will not kick you out. Even you are a prostitute. Now, these devotees, these princesses, were actually, after having that unfortunate experience of being kidnapped by Bhomasura, really, it's no fault of their own, but still, the social system was so strict back then that they were considered on the level of prostitutes. That's how they would be perceived, you see? So Prabhupada's just, you know, when he says that, that's what he's referring to. So even if you are a prostitute, he'll give you protection. So then Prabhupada says, so why should we not take shelter of Krishna? That is the natural conclusion. See? So, you know, just imagine the most wonderful person, you know, that you could possibly imagine, you know, the most kind, loving, and multiply that by a very, very large number, you know, and then you can begin to have some idea of how wonderful Krishna is. You know, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the wonderful message of the Krishna Consciousness Movement is that we all have an eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna. And this human form of life, which is what we all have here, this is an opportunity to revive our awareness of what our eternal spiritual relationship is with Krishna. And when I use that expression, revive our awareness, I don't mean just to become like intellectually familiar with it as an idea. That's not what Prabhupada meant or the Vedic literatures meant. It means that we can actually enter into that experience once again. Once again, by the mercy of this, you know, Vedic literature and our spiritual master Srila Prabhupada and all the spiritual masters coming in disciplic succession, going right back to Krishna, by the mercy of the knowledge they're giving us, we have the opportunity, we've been given the opportunity to reawaken our dormant love for Krishna, experience it even now within this present lifetime, and even better than that, at the end of this lifetime, return to live with Krishna eternally in the spiritual world. In an atmosphere of eternality, knowledge, bliss, and pure love for Krishna. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments about any of these points? Hopefully it was coherent and just at least somebody maybe meaningful. Yeah. Not a physical person. See, he doesn't. His body is not physical. His body is not material. Spiritual. Spiritual body. It doesn't get old. Doesn't get sick. Doesn't die. Doesn't forget anything. Yeah. He's a higher being, but he's a person. Hey, Rabbi, listen, I'll give you one. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Baruch Shem Kavod Malkuso Le'olam Bored. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Now listen to this part. Blessed be his name, whose glorious kingdom is forever and ever. Now if you got a name and you got a kingdom, you're a person. What do you reckon? That's it. Very interesting, John. Anybody else? Anything? Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. There's no difference between Krishna's body and his soul. The song is coming right now. Did you say the song or the soul?
Soul.
Oh, yeah, no difference between Krishna's body and his soul. He's entirely spiritual. And the song is now.